This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Welcome to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Should governments become the employer of last resort? Well, that's something we're going to explore today, because even in the best of times, there is unemployment. And needless to say, 2020 is not the best of times. Jobs have become an even bigger concern as COVID-19 wreaks havoc on the global economy. That said, employment was a focus in the US even before the pandemic took hold, with many pointing the finger at globalization and technological advancements for jobs lost. But is a federal backstop for jobs the solution to unemployment? For more on this, I speak with Pavlina Chernova, Associate Professor of Economics at Bard College and author of the book, The Case for a Job Guarantee. Pavlina, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I think just for some context here, job creation seems to be a perpetual concern for policymakers. You're proposing that the federal government guarantee jobs to deal with unemployment, even during times of growth and low unemployment. Why is that?
Because it is the most straightforward and direct solution. We talk a lot about jobs. Policymakers sometimes advance all sorts of policy proposals to deal with unemployment. But as we know, and as you pointed out in the introduction, unemployment is always with us. It seems to be a perennial feature of the economy. And so the most straightforward solution would be to create the missing jobs for the unemployed. And there are many reasons why the private economy, even in the best of times, is not able to employ everyone who knocks on the doors and sends resumes to private firms. And the public sector has a responsibility. The public sector is always responsible for the unemployed. And it is responsible not just for income support, but also for addressing the fallout and the social cost of unemployment. And so you can think of the job guarantee as a method of inoculation to prevent the various social costs, as well as directly create employment opportunities.
All right, very fascinating. Could you break that down for us a little further, though? How does the proposal work? Is this the government simply facilitating the process or actively taking headcount into its books?
It is actively participating in the job creation. We know that there are many well-intended policies. Governments provide tax cuts, subsidies to firms, incentives, and the like. At the same time, governments also provide, yes, unemployment insurance and income assistance, as well as training. But what ends up happening is that there is chronic shortage. Put simply, the private sector is not in the business of employing everyone. We know this well. If there's no commercial return to employing the extra person who comes and submits a resume, then that person will not be employed. And there are many other reasons why there will be folks without work. And they still, those folks would need employment. And so the indirect approach we have tried for a very long time, and what it ends up doing is just shuffling people along the unemployment line. There's always millions and millions out of work. So how about trying the direct solution? Instead of trying to nudge the economy in one direction or another, simply provide directly unemployment by employing the unemployed, and then do all those other things to help folks transition into better paid private sector employment.
All right. But one concern that I've seen is that this is the government essentially nationalizing jobs, which for better or worse, immediately brings communism to mind. Now, I understand that your proposal doesn't entail the government taking over the whole jobs market, but doesn't this disrupt the private sector and the existing labor market?
No, it supplements it. The job guarantee, as you pointed out in the introduction, is the employer of last resort. In the old former Soviet bloc countries, the government was the employer of the first and only resort. So the job guarantee is actually designed to work with a robust economy that has a robust private sector. But what we know is that economies, market economies, have this heartbeat, if you will, where they experience growth periods and then recessions. And the collateral damage are always people who are laid off and they lose their jobs. And so if we had a public option, if you will, for jobs that will employ the unemployed on standby, then it will coordinate, it will offset the behavior of the private sector. And when the private sector lays off workers, the public sector picks up the difference and provides the needed employment opportunities. When the private sector grows, then the public sector shrinks as folks transition into better paid private sector employment. So it's really meant to be a stabilizer for a market economy, to provide, if you will, job-led recoveries, and to provide better support for incomes and employment throughout the business cycle.
What kind of jobs are we talking about here in the public sector? Is it existing civil service jobs, or is the government going to have to create new, essentially create new departments and new jobs for this purpose?
It's not a, the program is not a replacement for existing civil service jobs. It is a program for residual employment for folks who need it. And so it will have to be a separate program with a separate administration. You can think a little bit of the New Deal programs in the United States in the 30s that were put in place as employment relief. And they were largely in public projects. But so public service is going to be a very suitable type of work that people can do, because the private sector is not in the business of doing a lot of these activities that don't have commercial return. And as we know, we have, you know, public work that is still neglected, such as environmental work, that is also very suitable. So the New Deal projects, for example, did a lot of environmental projects, and they launched the conservation movement in the United States. And so the job guarantee is also conceived of as a green job guarantee that helps address community needs, whether that's care for elderly, care for the young, care for the environment. But they are supplemental jobs to what would be sort of traditional, typical public service work. In fact, you can think of it this way. You can have the job guarantee workers be trainees in some civil service projects, or they can simply participate in new projects that are created by community groups on the ground.
In your writing, I think you've used the word living wages as opposed to minimum wage. With respect to the United States, what does a living wage mean?
In my proposal, I have proposed a job guarantee at $15 an hour, which will be a doubling of the minimum wage today. But I need to recognize that even 15 might not be sufficient to provide a living income for many communities. And so this is a policy question, how you implement the floor, the wage floor for the program, and how you phase it in. The main criteria for the program, for the job guarantee, is that it actually establishes a wage below which no one will fall. And the reason is because, again, the program is a public option. If somebody has the option to work at $15 an hour, then the private sector that offers less will be pressured to respond and to meet that standard. In the United States, nearly half of the population works below 15. We have a really deterioration in the wage structure and lots of jobs that are poorly paid. And so what we're looking for is to lift and firm up the floor at the bottom for working people. In other words, even if we raise the minimum wage, if we don't have an employment policy as the job guarantee, the person who cannot find a minimum wage job will be still earning zero. So it's not going to be an effective minimum wage floor. So we need to have these policies work in tandem, a minimum wage policy and a job guarantee policy that establishes the labor standard of minimum wages, but I should add also benefits.
Yeah, no, this is a very interesting proposal, because end of the day, one of the concerns that comes out for minimum wages is that, well, the corporate sector or private sector will hire less individuals. But if the public sector comes in to kind of absorb those jobs possibly lost, then hopefully we create a new equilibrium. But one of the criticisms I've seen is that by doubling the minimum wage to a living wage, isn't there a concern over inflation, Palvina?
Well, we have so much slack in the economy. I mean, inflation happens, you know, when people spend and have so much income and the economy cannot respond. The economy cannot produce what people want. So I think we're very, very far away from that moment. But in the United States, we have even a historical example. In 49, when the economy was as close to full employment as it has ever been, right after World War II, we nearly doubled the minimum wage, and we did not see the kind of inflationary problems that firms always warn about. And we also see, I mean, on a regular basis, major corporations in the United States, Amazon recently doubled their pay to 15, and we didn't see runaway inflation from, you know, prices of Amazon products. So I think raising the floor is simply stating that no working person should fall below that basic wage, if you will. The inflationary pressures will not come from this program, if there are inflationary pressures, because the program, as I described, acts anti-cyclically. You see, when the economy is booming, the program is shrinking. The government expenditure on employing people actually is shrinking, so it's a taming effect on any inflationary pressures that might emerge in the private sector. And of course, when the economy is in a deflationary environment, when it's in a recession, when it's laying off workers, it's the government that provides the support. So again, it offsets deflationary pressures. So it is better stabilizer than most automatic stabilizers that are out there.
I was speaking with Pavlina Chernova, associate professor of economics at Bard College and the author of the book, The Case for a Job Guarantee. Up next, we'll talk about inflationary concerns as well as footing the bill for zero unemployment and universal basic income. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasan. Today, I'm speaking with Pavlina Chernova, associate professor of economics at Bard College and the author of the book, The Case for a Job Guarantee. Pavlina, let's talk a little bit about numbers now. By your best estimate, how much would this cost the US government, for example?
When I wrote the book, I looked at an ambitious program that would employ 15 million people in the United States. That was about triple what the official unemployment rate was. Now, today, officially, we have about 15 million. So the cost of this program was 1.3% of GDP in the ambitious estimates. It is, as numbers go, it's a very small number as a percentage of GDP. But that would not be my typical concern. And I should say that the program, we didn't account for all the cost savings of unemployment. You know, for example, there are, as I enumerated, many social and indirect costs of unemployment that typically don't go into the calculus of the cost of unemployment. And so you could potentially come up with a budget neutral number, but that will not be the way I would measure success or desirability of the policy, because the way I see it is governments are paying for unemployment anyway. You know, we are paying not just in the form of unemployment insurance, but we are paying for all of the poverty alleviation programs, all of the social mental health costs that then ripple from the unemployed to their families, to the communities, to their children. These are already costs that we bear. And so the job guarantee is an investment. It's not an expense. It's an investment in people and in a better and more stable economy. So the budget impact is small. But the program is anti-cyclical, which means that in the midst of a pandemic, clearly the expenditure will have to rise. And as the economy recovers, then that expenditure is going to naturally shrink. And maybe I should say I had modeled the policy with colleagues at the Levy Economics Institute. And what we found is that the program creates a permanent increase in employment in the private sector. You would expect this. We have a tighter labor market, stronger demand, firms will be able to employ more. And we also have a very positive impact on states. States are typically responsible for anti-poverty programs. So now if you guarantee a living income to the unemployed, then you reduce a lot of the costs. And so we have about $50 billion in reduction in improvements in state budgets. And we also have negligible inflationary effect. After modeling a very aggressive, very bold program, we have less than 1% inflation from that expenditure.
Now, when it comes to funding this program, correct me if I'm wrong here, but this idea is backed or based in modern monetary theory, which differs from traditional thinking that prioritizes fiscal responsibility of the government budget. Could you briefly explain to us what modern monetary theory is and its relation to funding a job guarantee program?
Well, modern monetary theory is a way of looking at government budgets and arguing that they are distinctly different from household budgets. And that typically we need to measure success not in some debt and deficit ratios, but in terms of the way the government has spent and what it has spent for. And so modern monetary theory argues that many countries around the world have their own currencies. They can freely floating currencies that they control to various degrees. And if a government issues its own currency, it doesn't face the same kind of financial constraints that a household would. And in fact, they're fundamentally different. The reason why we have, if we call it public money, is so that we can serve the public purpose. And that will involve macroeconomic stabilization. I would argue that will involve, you know, employing the unemployed. So fiscal responsibility is whether we have spent appropriately to achieve those goals rather than trying to balance budgets, which would not be warranted for somebody who issues their currency, who technically self-finances expenditures. So the job guarantee basically represents that automatic stabilizer of government spending. We know that governments, without a doubt, will be spending to fight recessions, without a doubt, spending to fight problems with unemployment. And so the direct measure is the straightforward solution to those problems. And the expenditure is then controlled by the economic outcome, employment. There are countries, of course, that don't have the same kind of fiscal space because maybe they don't have their own currencies and they have very strict rules on how to manage their currency. So for them, the policy space is going to be a bit more limited. But I would say they will still be incurring large costs in recessions. And so, again, the direct job solution seems to be the more straightforward answer to the unemployment problem.
Now, that's it. Doesn't issuing more money put downward pressure on a nation's currency?
Not necessarily. I mean, depends for what purpose. As you noticed, the central banks around the world, and the Fed in particular, has been issuing a lot of reserves, if you will, to lend to the private sector, to purchase government securities and other financial assets. That in and of itself has not caused the dollar to tank, right? We don't see that. You know, how currencies are determined is a more complicated matter, but it does have to do with the health of the economy, with its productive capacity, with its trade relationships with others. We haven't really seen any trade wars or currency wars on the horizon. So the fact that a government and most governments around the world do this, that they can issue their own currency, is not a recipe for rapid deterioration in their exchange rate. Look at Japan, that has the highest debt to GDP ratio in the world, and they haven't seen this collapse in the end.
So I guess, I mean, the US and Japan are very interesting examples, right? But I can't imagine for Malaysia, we have our own currency as well, but I can't imagine that ratings agencies and international observers would be too pleased if we spent money like the national debt wasn't a pressing matter. So with that in mind, is this something that only some countries like the US and Japan can do? Countries with currencies and bonds that are considered essentially safe haven assets?
So, you know, to have your own currency is a real important privilege. And there is a reason why most countries have their own currencies. And what that means is that you have the technical power to employ the domestic unemployed resources. So a country like Malaysia can use its sovereign currency to put in place an employment program like the job guarantee. And I should say that large employment programs like the one I'm discussing, and normally in the recent history, we've seen them in the developing world. India has a rural employment guarantee. South Africa has had a successful expanded public works program. Argentina had. And so countries have experience with these bold employment programs. And what they do is they employ folks in the domestic currency. The trouble happens when Malaysia or other countries start borrowing in a foreign currency. And there is a real risk there that the country might not be able to earn the foreign exchange to repay the debt. But so long as the debt is denominated in the domestic currency, that it cannot default on it because it issues it.
Another option here, I think that's been talked a lot more in the last few years, is a suggestion from former presidential candidate Andrew Yang, who was also concerned about jobs when he was campaigning. He essentially proposed a universal basic income, or what he liked to term the freedom dividend. The proposal not only addressed income concerns, but also the issue of unappreciated care work. Why not go with a UBI instead of a jobs guarantee?
Well, all the experiments, UBI experiments, show that people still want work. So, you know, giving somebody $1,000 a month, no doubt, is going to help them. You know, I'm not sure if that will be the case for the ultra rich and, you know, what kind of freedom enhancements they get from the extra dividend. But certainly, if you give somebody cash, of course, it helps. But we know time and time again, people still face massive obstacles in the labor market. And so the job guarantee solves that problem. It ensures that if you need work, you'll find it. But there is another aspect to it. The job guarantee is, as I said, work that is in the community. A lot of it is, I talk about a National Care Act. It's care for people, for the environment. And so it does help with some of the care needs, you know, the elderly who are, you know, isolated in the midst of COVID. There will be somebody looking in on them, Meals on Wheels, that sort of thing. Andrew Yang is concerned about the stay-at-home caregiver who cannot work, and that is, you know, is a correct concern. So the job guarantee would be there when the caregiver wants to return to work, and we know what happens to mothers, stay-at-home mothers. They're the last ones to get hired, you know, after having a huge gap in their employment experience. But a universal child dividend would be my preferred way to go about and support caregivers at home. We have another program in the United States for veterans where their caregivers also get income support. So I think of them as a job guarantee and a basic income, where again, the job guarantee solves one particular problem, the absence of a job for those who need it. It's not the panacea to all kind of problems that people experience. And some sort of income support will be required depending on the kind of obstacles people are facing. It could be, they could be caregivers, but they could be students who can't afford to go to college. They could be retired folks that need decent retirement. So I think that they, you know, these policies need to play together rather than be either or.
I think a great point to end the conversation on. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Pavlina Chernova, Associate Professor of Economics at Bard College and the author of the book, The Case for a Job Guarantee. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.